briefly today a little bit about some of the work that I've been doing in the Adirondacks, looking at some long-term changes, 7 decades. So I have a data set from 1932, which if some of you know my advisor, Art Johnson, he's given some talks and put out some papers about this data set before. And it was last resampled in the mid-1980s, and I've come along now 20 years after that, and I'm trying to add some more information and some more knowledge to that database as I proceed through my PhD work. So today I'll talk a little bit about soil organic matter changes in some of these soils, just specifically in the forest floor. Now, to sort of give the whole talk away, I'm not reinventing the wheel here. I'm not going to come up with some brilliant and new discoveries. Quite to the contrary, we really didn't see any changes at all, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but I just wanted to put this up there quickly, as we're all acutely aware of the importance of soil organic matter, and as is made very evident by a lot of the talks at this conference, that people are concerned and interested in soil organic matter, not specifically, but as it relates to soil carbon and changes over time. So, can we store carbon in soils? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe it depends on the forest. Maybe it depends on where we're at. There's been a number of talks, one way or the other, that say yes, some say no, some say maybe. I will say that in our sites, I don't think so. So my current study was initiated back in the early 1930s as a PhD. Thesis by a gentleman named Carl Heimberger, who drove around in, that's a Model A Ford. He has sampled sites. He was concerned at looking at site productivity indices. He was looking at soil organic matter. He was looking at soil calcium and pH as indicators of what sites would be best to grow timber on. And he took very detailed and very careful measurements and analyses of this. And I actually got to see a copy of this thesis, so it's all on onion skin paper. And he went through his thesis and hand-corrected numbers. So we're very confident that the numbers that he reported are real, and it's been shown in subsequent work that he did a good job. So in 84, this was sort of rediscovered as the whole acid rain idea was being put forward and how it was impacting the Adirondacks. My advisor and one of his graduate students, Sally Anderson, went around, relocated a number of Heimberger sites and reported on the soil properties therein. And what they also did was establish permanent vegetation plots at each of the relocated sites. So what I've done over the past few years is gone back and resampled all of the soils that we were able to relocate, and I also remeasured all the vegetation. So we know the vegetation changes over the last 20 years, and now that all the soil sampling is done, we are now quantifying all the soil changes over that interval. So if you don't know where the Adirondacks are, they're in upstate New York. I use this slide a lot for all the talks that I give around Pennsylvania, so Louisiana's not on here, so there's no frame of reference. I apologize for that. So here are our sites. They are distributed. There's 56 sites. There are 20 northern hardwood, 12 pine, or 10 pine, and 12 spruce fir, and the spruce fir at these high elevation sites. There's this one site here with 14 samples on it. That's at Newcomb, and that was an experimental forest that was decommissioned sometime in the mid-1900s. And I'm not going to talk about that today, and I haven't included that because that was managed in one way or another for timber. So I will be talking about all my sites that are all on public lands, that are all on unmanaged stands. And that's good and it's bad. It's nice that we have unmanaged stands, so the only person who can manipulate what happens at these stands is Mother Nature. But unfortunately, I'm not allowed to cut down trees, add fertilizer, things like that. So You know, I don't have the opportunity to conduct a lot of the experiments and manipulations that a lot of people have talked about, and that would be interesting to see the effects of those on these sites, but I'm not able to do that. These sites largely stratify themselves by vegetation type, codominant tree species, and elevation. The spruce fir forests are at the highest. Balsam fir, red spruce, no surprise there. They're fairly, and I'll show a slide of the typical soil profiles. So these are pretty much fullest. They're high organic matter content and tend to be right on bedrock. Northern hardwoods, a lower elevation, yellow birch, sugar maple, beech, they tend to predominate on till. Pines, red pine, white pine on outwash sands, and they tend to be at the lowest elevation. So as you'll see in some of the comparisons that I do, because the soil properties, the soils are so different, and because the forest types are different, that a lot of the comparisons and analyses that we've done, we stratify them by vegetation type. We did quantitative pits, which for those of you who dug quantitative pits, they're a real joy. That's my advisor, actually, with his head in a hole there. And we quantitatively sampled all the organic horizons and mineral horizons down to the bottom of the rooting zone, which we called the beginning of the sea horizon. So these were typically 60 to some of the pine sites, some of the sandier outwash sites were over 100 centimeters deep. And then we took qualitative samples from the exposed pit face of the mineral horizons. So these are what some of the soil profiles look like. The spruce fir, sometimes there doesn't necessarily always have to be a mineral horizon there. A lot of these are right on bedrock, which is typically an orthosite throughout the Adirondacks and the spruce fir sites. Pines are tend to be on the sandy outwash soils in northern hardwoods, are on till mostly. So just in this talk, I want to address the questions of, did soil organic matter change in forest floor throughout these sites from 1932 through 2006? And if and looking at the different types of forests, which forests would we be likely to see change in? And number three is sort of more towards the future. Looking at these sites over time, can we identify any important factors that we might want to quantify, that we might want to look at, that might influence these sites as far as soil organic matter and soil carbon in the future? So I'll skip right to what we found. If you just do a quick back the envelope calculation, this organic matter index, as we'll call it, just percent organic matter times the horizon thickness, we didn't see any change. And with all these quantitative pits and with all this work that we've done, we want to be a little more quantitative. So this is pretty well established using bulk density, using percent organic matter and bulk density. You can establish a fairly predictive relationship. So we have the percent organic matter from 1932, but we don't have any idea of bulk density or any other quantitative measurements like that. So if we use the 2006 data from our quantitative pits, we can get an idea of how much soil organic matter content has changed over the interval from 32 to 06. And you can see that there are zero statistically significant relationships here. Nothing has changed. Now, just to sort of orient you, these are just overall, so if we lump all the sites together, so this is the total forest floor, just the OA, just the OE, and then if you lump all the different forest types together, and then if you break them down by forest type and horizon, you can get you can see there's one sort of overarching trend that although none of these changes are significant, and get into the semantics of it, if it's not significant, then it's not a change. But if you just look at the average values, that in 06 they are less than they were in 32, which I'm not entirely sure, and I And I don't know that you can definitively say one way or another what was causing this or what was happening here, but and I have a later slide here that I'll talk about in a second, that if you look at the veg change from 84 to 06, and I'm not saying that you can extrapolate this back all the way through the interval, that if you look at 84 through 2006, these forests weren't aggrading. They weren't getting bigger. So you can imagine that there would be, that may be reflected in the amount of soil organic matter, soil carbon that was input into these soils over that interval. One thing that I do want to point out is that the only real increase that we saw were in the pine sites. That disappeared on me. There, it's back. That there was an increase in the pine sites, which we may expect to see. This is some work that was done by Hooker and Compton. And I should backtrack a little bit and say that the pine sites, they were mostly flat sites, and they were a lot of them, probably seven or eight of the ones that we have in our survey, were used for agriculture, probably grazing land, back before they were let back to the forest. And this is some work that was done in Connecticut, I believe, that if you look at these filled-in circles here, so these were cultivated lands, that over time, the cultivated lands increased the amount of soil carbon in the forest floor and below the plow layer. So it's not entirely surprising that these pine sites sort of differentiate themselves from the other sites that we're seeing. And it's also interesting to note that the pine sites were the only ones that grew, that put on significant biomass over the interval from 84 to 06. So these pine sites seem to be a little bit different as far as the forests in the Adirondacks are concerned. However, these forests are fairly discontinuous. They're patchy. They don't represent a lot of the acreage and the land up in the Adirondacks. So just some intermediate conclusions. Soil organic matter didn't change. Some of the modeling results that one of my fellow graduate students in my lab has been working on in the Green Mountains, and some data from Hubbard Brook. He's not surprised that we didn't see anything. He's not seen anything in his model runs over the length of time that we're interested in. So said, you know, I'm not surprised that you didn't see anything. I wouldn't think that you would. And I think it also indicates that we didn't really have any sampling biases, that we wouldn't expect to see change, and we didn't see any changes from 32 to 06. And if you don't have the same people sampling the same soils at the same time, then you certainly stand to introduce different biases from different people sampling different things. But with these results and the fact that it is very easy to differentiate between the organic horizons on top of the mineral soils throughout this region, that we wouldn't expect to see any biases introduced here. The mineral soils might be a little different story, and give me a week and I'll have those numbers. I just didn't have a chance to get them done for this talk. And really comb through them and make sure we're taking everything into account that we need to. Again, organic matter on average was less in 06 than it was in 32, and I talked about that a second ago. And I talked about the pine thing. So where might these forests be going in the future? We've all been flooded with this idea of nitrogen, and I like to think of it as pollution as a good thing. Which may be overstating the issue a little bit, but if you take a look at the Nature paper, which basically says nitrogen is everything as far as NPP and carbon in forests are concerned, then if you take a look at the nitrogen gradient that's been shown for the Adirondacks, and when we start to look at the responsive forest in the Adirondack to this gradient, we can see on the left here, and it's not expanded, it's just to kind of put the point out there, that if you look at the foliar and concentrations of different hardwood species throughout this region, there is a response of trees, of forests to this end deposition gradient. And some initial work that Brendan McNeil and I have also done, looking at the growth rates of our plots, of my plots, with his end deposition gradient. We've seen some preliminary suggestions that the growth rates are responding positively to this end deposition gradient, and we look to try and do some more work with that in the future. And I'll also say that, you know, as I proceed through this, we're going to be looking more at nitrogen in the soils as well to see if that's reflected there. We can get more deadwood inputs from these sites. This is from some work that we did and published about the vegetation change. The species composition is changing in these sites away from sugar maple and beech dominance more towards beech. And if we look at some other work that's been done, if we switch from more sugar maple to more beech dominated, we can get enhanced soil organic matter, enhanced soil C accumulation over time. So quickly, the funding, a lot of the people that helped me out, my advisor, Dr. Johnson especially, and I'd also like to point out my mom will be very happy because she helps with these sites. She's actually dug quantitative pits, which is interesting. So my mom is, this was the first year in about 3 years that I haven't done field work, and she's very disappointed that she couldn't come up and help us dig and do field work, because she always brings cookies, brownies, and lasagna to starved graduate students and undergrads in the field. So that's all I have today. And like I said, I'll have lots more results probably in the next year. So hopefully I'll have a lot more to say next year. Thank you. I don't know yet. We have to, I've analyzed all of my samples from the field work that I've done, and theoretically, as I speak, all the CN analyzer is cranking up on what we have from the archive samples. So I don't know yet. Those samples are being processed, hopefully right now. Sure. This is just simple LOI stuff. So just combust it at 550, and the protocols that I did were directly from his thesis. So we have, and there's a lot of other analyses too that have been done. You know, the progression of different technologies or whatever through time, and it's been shown that if you do things carefully, you can find out where the bias exists, but just for LOI, there, you know, it's, you know, pretty standard. She would love it.
And Ontario too.
And Ontario. Second question, my question is, have you looked at the climate record? And I ask that in relationship to your speculation on nitrogen relationships and growth in your plot.
I haven't looked at that, and that's one of the things that to get input as, you know, people with different perspectives, different ideas on what may be controlling things, that with the, you know, preponderance of GIS data and things like that, to analyze these things in the context of my plots is a lot more straightforward than it used to be. That data is a lot more readily available. So that's certainly something, you know, as I get more into the analyzing the whole nitrogen thing, we're certainly going to be fishing for anything and everything that we can find to see, you know, does that have an effect, and that's certainly something that